thank you, and welcome to the show.
It's Halloween and we hide behind masks.
I know it's Halloween.
Halloween fun is afoot.
Happy Halloween to you too.
It's just so childish.
There are grown-up ways to enjoy Halloween.
Well, we're not doing that.
Well, we're not doing that.
The boogeyman is coming.
Ha ha, happy Halloween.
And now, it's showtime.
The Big Wake Up Call.
Rewind.
Back on the Big Wake Up Call, and time for my next guest. She is a pop culture icon who's certainly making headlines with stories revealed in her new memoir. The book is Yours Cruelly, Elvira. And we're going to visit with Elvira, Mistress of the Dark, also known as Cassandra Peterson. And good morning. Welcome to the show.
Morning. A little early, but I'm still here.
I looked it up, and you were last on our show in 2015 to talk about Food Network's Halloween Wars. Did I say something at the time to offend you that it took us 6 years to get you back on?
No, you were awesome. I just have been very, very, very busy. I'm always busy creating the next thing. So, just had to take a break.
Certainly been newsworthy this past week. Did you have any idea how much this book would blow up? I have seen you. I've seen pieces on you everywhere this week.
Well, I was hoping it would. I certainly was hoping. I wasn't sure that it would, but it's kind of exceeded my wildest expectations so far. It's been selling like crazy. It's a bestseller on Amazon. I'm very happy. I know I have some very kooky and interesting stories to tell, so I think people will be pretty shocked and excited about some of the stories in my book.
Is your long-term relationship, is that what you expected to be the main takeaway of the book? Because I read that part and thought, oh, wow, that's interesting. I'm glad she learned who she was. But there's so much more in the book I found a lot more interesting. That didn't strike me as such a bombshell declaration.
You know, it didn't strike me as that either, and I was a little surprised that they are concentrating on that. That's just one of the many things I talk about. I think there are many things in there that are a lot more shocking than that. I think in this day and age, you know, people don't care about what you do in your private life that much on a personal relationship basis. But I didn't think it would be the biggest thing about the book. And I hope when people read it, they don't think it is either.
Like, what's more worthy of conversation to me is the story we learned about today regarding Wilt Chamberlain assaulting you. And I just that had to feel like an absolute awful no-win situation for you.
It absolutely was. I've already had people say, why didn't you do something? Why didn't you say something? It's like, are you kidding? I was an out-of-work actress and ex-showgirl, and I'm going to come up against the most famous athlete in the world at that time. He sexually assaulted me, and I know that if I would have tried to take it to the police or whatever, I would have been shamed and disgraced, and he would have gone on to be who he was, which was one of the most famous athletes in the world. So I never told anybody about it. No one. I don't think anybody in my life except my ex-husband knew about that.
We find out in the book, it's a private conversation you had with Elvis that changed your life. How did you get to have a one-on-one chat with Elvis? Because he usually had everybody around him.
Yeah, that was crazy. It was I was working in Vegas then as a showgirl when I was 17. And Elvis came to see the show with his entourage. They invited myself and one of the other showgirls back to the party that they were having there. And she was dating Joe Esposito, who was Elvis's road manager at the time. So that's how she and I got invited. And there were a large group of people, 20, 30 people there. And little by little, this is like 2-3 in the morning, they faded away, went on their way, left. And I was left there with Elvis, sitting on the couch, chatting about everything. It was amazing. We spent until maybe the next morning around 9, 10 a.m. in the morning talking. And he was giving me lessons about life, talking to me about not doing drugs, about astrology and numerology and spirituality. And then he got into why was I so young and in Vegas? And he said it was not a good place for me to be. It was my dream to be a Vegas showgirl, but he said really that I'd accomplished it and I needed to move on. And he talked me into getting singing lessons because he said I had a good voice. We sang together at the piano. And I took his advice. He was Elvis, for God's sake, you know. And I left Vegas, and I ended up going to Europe and getting into a pop group over there, singing in a band.
See, now, that was the most incredible story for me as an Elvis fan, that he was really looking out for you and really wanted to guide your career, that he saw something in you. That's just amazing.
It is amazing. And people always, you know, think that, you know, I always described it as a date with Elvis. I just didn't know what to call it. What I call a meeting with him, I don't know. But there was a little kissing going on, but as you know, and I sure as all the people working with him knew, I was underage, so there was no hanky-panky. But he did give me advice that stuck with me for the rest of my life and changed the entire direction of my life. So without him, I would now be the oldest showgirl in Las Vegas.
And it was fun to find out you were in the Groundlings with Paul Rubens and Phil Hartman. Was Phil already an absolute comedy genius then?
Oh, he was so freaking funny. I mean, in the Groundlings, the two really big stars were Phil Hartman and Paul Rubens. They were brilliant. They came up with the characters that nobody could believe. I have one character, Elvira, Mistress of the Dark. Both of them had dozens and dozens of characters. They're just brilliant. And yeah, Phil, the first time I saw the show and I saw Phil do a character he had called Chick Hazard, it just blew me away. He was one of the reasons I wanted to get into the Groundlings. He and Paul Rubens, it was just so amazing. They were making up comedy as they were going along. And I thought, this is what I want to do, because that's what I did when I was a kid. Just put on shows for the neighbors and for my family and make everything up as I went along. So I thought, what a fantastic gig.
So many fun stories in the new book, It Is Yours Cruelly, Elvira. It is available wherever books have sold. My guest, of course, is the author. Well, thank you so much for joining me today, and we would love to have you back before 2027.
Thank you. I would love to be back. Thanks so much for plugging my book.
October 31st, vote no on Halloween. Halloween supports dangerous roving gangs of children going door to door to get their fix. When it comes to healthcare, Halloween doesn't care. Under Halloween, tooth decay rates have doubled and instances of child obesity have skyrocketed. Halloween is deceptive. Sure, it may look like a sexy firefighter, but don't count on Halloween if your house is burning down. And Halloween is not a legal holiday. If Halloween had its choice, it would allow for more illegal holidays to invade and take over your calendar. Don't be tricked. Halloween is no treat. This October 31st, vote no on Halloween. Paid for by Thanksgiving.
The Big Wake Up Call.
Rewind.
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 It's the Big Wake Up Call on AM 1280 WBIG. I'm Ryan Gatenby, and my next guest is probably best known for his roles as Michael Myers in Rob Zombie's popular reboot of the Halloween series. He's also got a brand new project out on DVD called Compound Fracture, and we're going to chat with Tyler Main. Welcome to the show.
Hey, guys. How you doing? Thanks for having me.
Good. Great to have you on the show. When you were growing up in Canada, up there, was Halloween the holiday? Was that as big a deal up there as it is down here? I just feel like people are absolutely nuts this year for Halloween.
Yeah, it was huge. The only big difference is, you know, we could be Halloweening in about 2 feet of snow up there.
Yeah.
You know, depending on the year.
And then as a default costume up there, do most people just put on their hockey gear?
Yeah, pretty much. Hockey gear or just dress up as a snowman.
Now, you're certainly someone who's probably bound to be noticed when you go out in public. Is there a common thing that people recognize you for, or are people coming up to you noticing you from many of the different things you've done?
from many of the different things. It's I've had people come up and go, "Oh, I loved you in X-Men and Sabretooth." The strangest one is I was in one of my favorite stores, Costco, and a woman came up behind me and tapped me on the shoulder, and she goes, "Excuse me, I don't mean to bother you, but were you Michael Myers in the Halloweens?" And I thought that was kind of weird. I go, "Yeah, how did you know?" She goes, "Oh, I recognized your walk."
Oh, wow.
Which is, that's probably about the craziest one that I've had.
Now, I think most people know that you started out in pro wrestling before becoming an actor. And we've seen quite a few former wrestlers. They've had success making that transition. Is there something about being a wrestler, about the training that kind of prepares you for a career in TV or film? Is it working on that kind of performance aspect of a wrestler?
Yeah, you know, the way I call wrestling, it's theater in the round. You know, you're there to entertain people and put on a show. It's just, I mean, for me, my transition came when I was in Mexico wrestling. I was the lead villain over there, and they asked if I wanted to do a Mexican wrestling movie. And I said, "Well, I don't know how to speak Spanish." They're like, "Don't worry about it. We'll dub your voice." You know, this was in the late 80s, and I got to play an intergalactic vampire that shot laser beams through my fingertips, had three midget sidekicks dressed up as aliens, and a pink fog followed me everywhere. And like I say, it was the 80s. Don't judge.
Well, but, I'm not judging at all. I'm thinking if that movie's available, I need to see that now.
I am not going to tell you the name of that movie. But then I went on to, to do things like the X-Men, and that's when I hung up my wrestling boots and transitioned into the film. And I've been very lucky to, do the X-Men, do Troy with Brad Pitt, where I was King Ajax, Joe Dirt, eventually do three films with Rob Zombie, two of them being the Halloween reboots as Michael Myers.
And how did you meet up with Rob Zombie the first time? Was this just some sort of a chance encounter, or did he seek you out? Was he looking, thinking about you for this big role?
Well, the thing is, I did The Devil's Rejects first with him, and I was brought on to the role of Rufus. So I was working with him for 4 days on that, and thought nothing of it. And then a couple of years later, the phone rings, and it's Rob Zombie, and he says, "Hey, I got this new movie I want you to be in, I want you to be a lead of. It's Halloween, and I want you to be Michael Myers." And I'm like, "Oh, my God." And he says, "If you don't do it, I'm not going to do it." And I said, "Well, tell me a little bit about it." And he said, "Okay, we're going to make Michael Myers more than a one-dimensional character. We're going to show how he's a product of his environment, show his childhood, his upbringing, and show how he has turned into the killing machine that he becomes." And when he explained it and said, he's going to give me freedom to do what I want to do with the role too. And I was like, "All right, let's do it." And we ended up doing two of them.
Well, that's interesting you mention that, because I think one of the reasons behind the success of the Rob Zombie series is you get a little more into the psychology and the background of the character. So when you're playing a character like that, are you trying to get into the mind? Are you doing what you can do to try to psychologically relate to the character?
Yeah, as an actor, you do your research. I saw all the Halloweens except for three where Michael Myers doesn't appear in. I don't know what the heck that's called.
Right.
But I did that, and then I also did my research on serial killers to see how they would fit into society without people detecting, like people that live next to Bundy and all these other serial killers, Gacy and that. They're like, "We never knew. He was such a nice guy," and he's like, it's just horrifying to think that your next-door neighbor could be a serial killer. And that's what I wanted to bring to the role, too.
And is that an extra challenge, too, as an actor? And maybe you had previous experience doing the Mexican wrestling movie. Having your face obscured, you've really got to physically embody the character and communicate a lot that way. That had to be an additional challenge.
Yeah, I mean, it's a lot easier if you have dialogue and you get to tell somebody what you're feeling.
Right.
To get your emotions across. But when you are in a mask, you just have your body language. And, that's what I wanted it to be. Like when Michael Myers is in the asylum, I wanted to slump over a little bit. And as he slowly got back to his the iconic costume, where he's upright and just the killing machine, so I wanted to portray him as he's evolving. And, people, the editor... Glenn Garland said, did they have like six masks with different facial expressions? Because it looked like you were changing your facial expression all the time. And no, it was just my body language and the way I held my head and that. And he said, wow, that was just, it was just something to be able to see that, you know, and just to be able to do that and be a part of it was fantastic.
And obviously successful and resonating with people if you're being recognized in Costco's by the way you walk.
Yeah, right. That's a little crazy.
So, Tyler, tell us about Compound Fracture, which is now out on DVD. This is kind of cool that you've got three icons of the genre in one film.
Yeah, you know, my wife and I started Main Entertainment. We wrote Compound Fracture and produced it. And I wanted to bring the horror community together, and I wanted to have three iconic serial killers in this. So it's got myself, Michael Myers from Rob Zombie's Halloween. It's got Derek Mears, who is Jason from the new Friday the 13th. And it's got Muse Watson, the killer from I Know What You Did Last Summer, all in this, along with other great people like Leslie Easterbrook, Daniel Roebuck, Todd Farmer. I mean, the cast is just phenomenal. And it's just a really great story. It's a supernatural thriller about a family that has to come together after a 20-year absence because the father is getting dementia. And we all end up back at the family home, which has been turned into a high-tech security compound to keep someone or something away from the family. So it's an interesting little story, and you get to see Michael Myers and Jason go at it head-to-head in this movie.
It's kind of like fantasy football. It's like I say, hey, I want to put Jason and I want to put Michael Myers and Ben Willis in one movie. So to make that happen, that's kind of cool.
Yeah. It's a lot of fun, and we had a great time making the film, and it comes across on screen, and it's getting really good reviews, and we're just very pleased that that's our first one out of the gate. We've got another one that we're working on right now called Penance Lane, which is more of a horror thriller that we're going to be filming next year. And, so please look out for Main Entertainment.
And that's Compound Fracture on DVD now, featuring our guest, Tyler Main. Tyler, great to talk to you, and I appreciate you being on the Big Wake Up Call today.
Yeah, great to talk to you. And if people want to get signed copies of Compound Fracture, they can go to Main, M-A-N-E, entertainment.com. Thanks for having me, and happy Halloween.
Happy Halloween. Thank you.
Hi, everyone. This is Kat with a message about tomorrow's office Halloween party. The company wants us to know the following. No dressing as a Karen, since we have people of that name working for the company. No dressing as the opposite sex, as that would be mocking the company's trans policy. No dressing as anything quote-unquote sexy. Nothing political like dressing as the president's drool nurse. Nothing satanic or religious. Nothing COVID-related, including bats, fangs, doctors, or nurses. Sugarless candy will be provided, no nuts, plus soft drinks and water. I'll be dressed as a giant candy corn again. See you at the party. It's going to be a lot of fun.
The Big Wake Up Call.
Rewind.
We are back on the Big Wake Up Call, AM 1280 WBIG. I'm Ryan Gatenby, and it's time for my next guest. He is a horror movie legend. He played Jason in four movies. Also the star of the Hatchet series. The fourth one, Victor Crowley, is available on digital and on demand February 6th. And of course, it's Kane Hodder. Good morning.
Good morning.
It is so great to talk to you, Kane. How are you today?
I'm doing great. I'm, excited that the movie is finally going to be available to everyone because we had to keep it secret for so long.
Yeah, now this really caught people by surprise. Why was it a secret and how did this come about? Because it's almost been 5 years since Hatchet 3.
Right. We shot this film, Victor Crowley, last September, Adam didn't announce that it existed publicly until this past August. So, as you can imagine, that's a pretty difficult secret to keep. Maybe not so much for the cast, because they have something to gain from it remaining a secret, but for the crew to not spoil the surprise was pretty admirable, I think, because that's a tough thing. What have you been working on? Well, I can't really say, you know.
That is pretty amazing, because, you know, one hint on Twitter could have ruined the whole thing.
Exactly. So I just appreciate the entire cast and crew keeping it a secret, because it was so amazing for Adam to make that announcement at the screening of a retrospective, as the audience thought it was going to be, of the previous three movies. The audience was surprised when Adam said, by the way, this is the fourth movie. So instead of a retrospective, they were the first audience to see the new Victor Crowley movie. And so many fans have told me that it is their favorite one of all of them. People that were able to get to the screenings when Adam did his junket with the film, showing it different cities, people were able to get there, and they just love it.
Now, are we picking up where Hatchet 3 left off? Are we jumping into the future? Where do we see it going?
We are years later from the end of the third one, because I don't know if you really realize, or the fans do necessarily, the first three movies take place over one weekend, actually.
Okay.
So this is years later after the supposed end of Victor. So it's an interesting way to bring him back. And once again, Adam got a cast together that were just amazing. And, you know, from they're all people that I already knew, almost every one of them. So it's kind of fun to work with your friends anyway.
Now, you've got one of our favorite guys, Q from Impractical Jokers. You've got Brian in this one. Are you allowed to say if you kill him or not?
Well, let's face it. Do many people ever survive an encounter with Victor? Not often. So I think you can imagine that it doesn't go well for him. But, you know, it was so much fun when Adam told me he was going to be in the movie, because I'm a big fan of his and his show and all four of the guys that I had met all of them before. I went to Conan O'Brien because Q invited me to come over there and say hello to the rest of the guys because we had met. So the fact that he was going to be in a Hatchet movie, I was very excited because I'm still a big fan of that show. So, and he's just such a big horror fan, he felt honored to be there. I felt honored to be doing what I did to him. So it worked out well.
Are you still doing all your own stunts in this one?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I the only person that's ever been adult Victor in any of the movies is my buddy Rick McCollum. And that's only when necessary. Like, in the first movie, Rick was in the Victor makeup because I was Thomas Crowley. I was Victor's father as myself, so I couldn't obviously do both characters if they're in the same scene together.
Yeah.
And also there's a scene in Victor Crowley in the fourth one where it was necessary to have him in the makeup, but I don't want to spoil why it is. But so I'm still doing all the shots, all the scenes myself, because I still enjoy it. I'm still in what I consider good shape for doing stunts, considering I've been doing it for so long. So I've had a great stunt career, and it's hard to for a stunt person to give up what they've done their whole lives, you know what I mean?
Has shooting a stunt scene, has that changed over the years as technology has evolved, or is it still just depending on exact and precise choreography?
Well, I would say both of those things. It'll always be precise choreography, whether it is assisted by what I term wire work. A lot of big action movies have stunt people on wires.
Yeah.
And that's a whole art form unto itself. We never used to do that 25 years ago. You would never see a person on a wire. They had to do the stunt themselves, but wire work can enhance a scene, but also at the same time, it's far easier on the body when you don't have to hit the ground every single take.
Sure.
When the wire is figured, so you go flipping backwards, but it stops you before you hit the ground. Back in the day, we used to have to go flipping backwards and hit the concrete, for instance. So the cumulative effect of doing stunts can be a little easier at this point in time.
Like, would it be easier now in 2018 to literally rip someone's head apart like you did in Hatchet 1?
Well, that's always been easy for me, whether it's on camera or not. But anyway, that part of it hasn't changed all that much because people still love practical effects.
Right.
Which is actually doing that thing instead of optically enhancing it. So people still love to see the actual thing happen. It's far more work for the makeup people and stuff like that, but I think people still like that kind of thing. And I've been told that a lot of people still like the old way of doing stunts too, where you can cringe when you see the stunt person hit something. You can feel it. So, you know, I don't think the practical effects will ever go away.
Do you still get comments on the people still come up to you about the sleeping bag scene in part 7?
Oh yeah, absolutely. In fact, I've had fans recently, a couple conventions, I've done a photo op in the part 7 makeup. So that's kind of cool for fans to get to take a picture of me while I'm in the makeup like I wore in the movie. So that being said, I've had a couple very enterprising fans show up for that photo op hopping in a yellow sleeping bag.
Awesome.
So, yeah, they still love it. Still my favorite Jason kill of all time.
And Victor Crowley, that's on digital and on demand February 6th, of course, starring Kane Hodder. And, well, looking forward to it. And thank you so much for calling in today.
Hey, it's my pleasure. Thanks for having me on. And I look forward to seeing you.
Today's show is brought to you by Halloween, the only national holiday where it's still politically correct to ask, hobo or sexy nurse?
The Big Wake-Up Call.
Rewind.
We are back on the Big Wake-Up Call. I'm Ryan Gatenby, and time for my next guest, who is the director and co-star of the new horror thriller 13 Fanboy. You can see it in select theaters and on demand this Friday, and we are going to visit with Deborah Voorhees. Good morning, and welcome to the show.
Well, thank you. Good morning.
How are
you
doing?
Thank you for having me.
Oh, it's good to have you here. How are things where you are?
Oh, it's beautiful. We are very excited and heading to LA for our premiere.
Now, how excited are you that you were able to push for this Halloween release date? I mean, it could not be more perfect.
I agree. I am absolutely thrilled. I can hardly wait to see the fans' reactions. Those that have seen it so far, we've had the fans have been loving it.
Now, I'm only about halfway through the movie, so with no spoilers, can you share with us what 13 Fanboy is all about?
Absolutely. It's about a fanboy who has a deadly obsession for the actors and Friday the 13th, and also Dean Wallace of Halloween. He was had an abusive father who kept him in the basement, and so all he had were these stack of VHS tapes for Friday the 13th and Halloween. And so he felt like the characters in the film were his family. He didn't realize they were actors. And he wrote to them, and when they didn't write back, much later in life when he grew up, he was very angry.
Well, and it's a cliche, perhaps, but this is certainly a love letter, but in a very creepy way, maybe a love/hate letter to the characters of all the Friday the 13th movies.
Right. It's definitely an intense thriller. It's a horror film. It has slasher elements, and it's a whodunit all wrapped into one. I think one of the creepiest parts about it, scariest parts, is that the actors are actually playing themselves. So when I went to them, I had to say, I want you to play yourself as an actor from the series, and you are being stalked. And that added a lot higher level of fear for the actors and worry. Some people jumped in right away. Dee Wallace looked at the script and was like, oh my gosh, why hasn't anybody else thought of this? Why hasn't this already been done? And she was on board right away. I had some people who it really frightened that concept. To play a character being stalked is very different than you're supposed to play you, albeit a fictional version of your you, but it's still you being stalked.
See, now, I think you would want to jump at that opportunity, because who would not want to play kind of an exaggerated version of themselves? My dream, and maybe we can make this happen with another, my dream is to be like the first person to be killed in a horror movie. That would be my the ultimate achievement as an actor. I want to be the first one to go.
Well, you know, I like to think of myself as the dream maker. And anybody who wants to die, I might be able to help you.
Now, how long has this been in the works? I imagine it was quite a challenge tracking down a lot of these actors to be in the film. From writing this to what we're going to see this Friday, how long of a process has this been for you?
It's been about 3 years starting writing all the way through pre-production, getting, you know, casting, production, and then editing, and then distribution. So for in the film world, that's actually pretty fast to get a film out, but it is a very long process. It's, you know, like you're starting a new business every time you do it. And it helped, I think, contacting the cast, since I was already a kind of an alumni of Friday the 13th.
Right.
But also I had my producing partner, Joel Paul Reisig. He had, 25 films that he had distribution for under his belt. And of course, that also led credibility to, lended credit credibility to the film. So for the most part, people kind of really were excited and said yes right away. But we definitely had some that it took a little bit more of chatting. And one in particular passed on us, the first final girl, Adrienne King from the first Friday the 13th. She had a real life stalker. And it was a very serious situation. And she never talked to me about her direct experience too much. I know that she tried to escape him and went to London, and he followed her.
Oh my gosh!
And it was a pretty scary and bad situation. And so for her, it was way too close to reality for her, and so she passed.
From writing this to then casting this, I would imagine this movie had to be very adaptable, because depending on who was signing on and how that fit into the story, it had to be a little bit flexible the way you were kind of shaping the narrative.
Absolutely. For each person, I tried to make some element that was specifically about them that brought in who they were in real life. So for instance, Kane Hodder, he played Jason 4 times in the film.
Yeah.
Friday the 13th, he played Jason. And so he is extremely famous in the horror world as the silent killer. Well, and he loves those roles, but he also has wanted to play some dramatic roles that he hadn't gotten an opportunity to, because sometimes you go in for an audition and somebody's like, no, we love you, you're fantastic, but we can't see you in a role like this. And so he definitely gets to show his acting chops in this, and does a brilliant job.
13 Fanboy is in select theaters and on demand this Friday. My guest is the director and co-star, Deborah Voorhees. And thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you. Take care.
Imagine you are a pumpkin. You've grown from a tiny seed, bathing in the sunshine and drinking in the rain. And then you're ripped from Mother Earth, decapitated, gutted with a melon baller and left to rot on someone's porch the entire month of October. That's the real horror this Halloween. But there is something you can do. This Halloween, visit the environmentally friendly pumpkin patch, Global Gourds. There, you can sponsor a pumpkin of your choice and give it the chance to have a full, rich life on the vine. Every month, you'll get a photo of the pumpkin you're sponsoring, giving you a sense of purpose and pride that you've saved another pumpkin from senseless slaughter. Visit Global Gourds today and help a pumpkin have a better October. Conveniently located next to Thankful Thanksgivings, the farm for transgendered turkeys.
The Big Wake Up Call.
Rewind.
Back on The Big Wake Up Call, AM 1280 WBIG. I'm Ryan Gatenby, and it's time for our next guest. And oh my goodness, he is joining us just in the nick of time. The author of a brand new survival guide, You're a Vampire, That Sucks. And let's welcome Count Dominic DC. Welcome to the show.
Oh, thanks for having me.
I appreciate you calling in. And you would think, you know, this is just an irrational fear. But you get to this time of year, you hear stories, and I never know. So I do. I want to be prepared should I find myself being turned into a vampire.
Well, then this book, You're a Vampire, That Sucks, a survival guide, is the book you need, because pop culture, modern media has spread so many myths about vampires that, you know, what kills them, what strengths they have is all over the board. And this book just really narrows it down, tells you which ones are real, which ones are false, and also how to enjoy your new undead life.
Well, that's what I appreciate is, as you mentioned, there's lots of books about, you know, the fear and how to avoid vampires. But I like the practical approach here. And if you don't mind, I have a few questions that I've always wondered about.
Of course.
And one of those is food for vampires. Now, I saw a movie not too long ago, and it suggested that it was only blood and they would be violently ill if they eat regular food. Is that true?
That is true. A vampire consists of a blood diet, okay, blood only. But there are some workarounds if you miss those foods from the living days.
Okay.
You do a 10% beverage of your choice, 90% blood mixture, and you can enjoy it. So, for instance, if you like that cup of coffee in the morning, you just simply put 10% coffee, 90% blood. I prefer blood from a guy named Joe because I like to play off puns. And then you've got a nice blood-infused coffee.
Well, that's good because, I don't know if I'd want to be immortal if that were the case, if I couldn't ever enjoy anything else.
Exactly. And then if, you know, for food, all you have to do is find somebody who recently had your favorite food of choice. Perhaps that is a pizza. You know, get some coming out of their Pizza Hut and just snack on them, and you get to taste human blood with their recently eaten pizza.
I know.
Make sure there's no garlic on it.
Oh, wow. I never thought about that. Wow, so you'd have to kind of study the menu of these restaurants and get to know that before you launched into somebody.
Very important. Very important. Unless, like, you know, Taco Bell or something like that that doesn't use any natural ingredients, then you know you're safe.
Now, when we see vampires in the movies, they're living in these huge, ornate mansions. They seem to have, like, unlimited resources. But you know, what if you're just a regular guy? You're turned into a vampire. You're struggling to pay a mortgage anyway, and now you've got to set yourself up for eternity. How do you make ends meet?
You know, it's tough. It's tough, especially since a vampire can't work during daylight hours. It takes out a lot of job options.
Oh, yeah.
For those vampires who are still feeling the need to work within the human world, detective work is very popular because it helps feed our hunting nature, and also the vampire skill set allows you to excel at in the field. But there's also vampires who become corporations. By setting up a corporation and becoming that corporation, not only do they last eternally, but in the eyes of the U.S. government, corporations are people. So it's completely legitimate. And then, of course, there's jobs within the vampire community, whether it be blood supplier or, you know, working in the vampire relocation program, because vampires have to move about every 10 years or so.
How did you go about putting this book together? What kind of vampire-related research did you do?
Well, you know, it covers all the mythology from the beginnings of from oral traditions to Bram Stoker to our modern day Anne Rice or Twilight. And from there, I just tweezed out the myths and the facts and which ones are real and which ones are half-truths and explained them here in the survival guide to help the recently turned vampire enjoy their new undead life and survive.
Now, why do you think
a lot of myths.
Why do you think there was such a shortage of practical knowledge out there about being a vampire? Is it just such a closed community? It's hard to break through and get that information out there?
Part of vampire survival is secrecy. You know, the less people who know you exist, the better. And, you know, vampires themselves have spread these myths throughout time to help save our own skin, if you will. You know, but the problem is, with all these myths out there, the recently turned vampire didn't have a chance anymore, which is why You're a Vampire That Sucks, a survival guide, was written to help them with their new powers, their weaknesses, and their new life.
Now, I think I should go back here. We might be burying the lead here or ignoring the proverbial elephant in the room. When you talk about we and us in that, so you yourself, you have been turned, you're a living vampire?
For this book, I am, yes. For this book, I am.
Well, I was just wondering if the Count was like an honorific title, or you hold a position somewhere?
I gave myself the title of Count, and I will give myself many titles throughout the years.
Why not?
It's good for anonymity.
Now, as you mentioned, as a vampire, if you're not already, you've got to learn to be a night owl, and listening to a lot of overnight radio, that might be terrifying, but you're going to be spending a lot of time in your coffin. So how do you go about choosing one for yourself without, like, letting on your intentions?
Well, luckily, everywhere has coffins. Costco sells coffins now.
Really?
Today's modern coffin is so much more comfortable than anything you've gotten back in the day. I mean, these coffins are more comfortable than, like, most college dorm rooms beds. But you can just say you're buying in advance in preparation.
Oh, that's true.
You're throwing yourself a 50-year birthday party. But, you know, you're going to want to find a coffin that's comfortable and has the modern conveniences. I would personally put an iPad on top of my coffin so I could surf the web and watch a little TV before going to sleep.
Wow, I did not know about the coffins at Costco, so I can get a 50-cent churro and set myself up for the afterlife. Man, that place has everything.
It really does. I was shocked.
What is the most common misconception about vampires that you felt you needed to shatter in the book?
You know, the most common misconception is anything to do with the demonic creature. Vampires are not demonic creatures. They're just the undead trying to live on this planet Earth. You know, so they have reflections in the mirror. Holy water does nothing to us. But others could be a little more deadly, like a stake. Now, the stake was believed to have to be made of wood or aspen wood because Judas was hung himself on the aspen tree, but really any steak's going to do. So even if you got a pair of chopsticks from the night before your Chinese food or a pen, that'll do just fine in vanquishing a vampire, and that's what vampires have to be careful of.
Now, how do vampires feel? They had a huge run of popularity maybe a decade or so ago, and then suddenly it all became about zombies. Do they kind of relish that? They're kind of in the background now and can do what they do, or are they a little jealous that they're not getting, their recognition?
You know, vampires are still getting plenty of recognition. Just turn on the CW and you're going to see the Vampire Diaries, the originals, and then you've got your cable networks with things like The Strain. Vampires are just as popular now as ever, so there's no jealousy towards those stupid zombies.
Is there a challenge for a vampire to stay current with fashion to blend in? Because, again, whenever you see them, unless it's like a super modern portrayal, but a vampire is always kind of dressing in the clothes that wherever they were turned, that's kind of where they stay fashion-wise.
Yeah, it's a habit of older people where we don't like to change, and vampires kind of get stuck in their old ruts. But, you know, most vampires are going to be smart enough to turn with the times and change the times. That becomes a big issue when a vampire decides to hibernate for 100 years or so.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, you go to sleep, pod pieces and wearing a sword is all the rage, and then you wake up, and all of a sudden you look like a fool.
Yeah, whenever I just don't see a whole lot of vampires wearing khakis, so I wondered.
They just don't go well with the skin complexion.
Well, Count, the brand new book, You're a Vampire, That Sucks. So where do we find out more? Can we keep up with you online? Are you tweeting from the vampire world?
Yeah, Twitter, Facebook. I got my own website, www.dominicdc.com, DominicDicce. I left out the count. And the book is available at Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and your local bookstore. Just send your familiar to the bookstore so you don't get burned in the sun.
All right, well, I appreciate the research and the practical advice. The book, You're a Vampire, That Sucks, by our guest, Count Dominic Dicce. Well, great to talk to you, Count, and thanks so much for calling in today.
Thank you for having me on.
This program is brought to you by the Dyslexic Zombie Society. Perfect complexions, never hungry, and afraid of the dark.
We are back on the Big Wake Up Call, AM 1280, WBIG. I'm Ryan Gatenby, and it's time for our next guest. And she is appearing on the season finale of Food Network's Halloween Wars as a very special guest judge. And you can catch the episode coming up on Food Network this Sunday night at 8 o'clock. Special guest judge, Elvira, Mistress of the Dark. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you.
Now, I know this has got to be your busy time of the year, so I appreciate you taking the time to call in today.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, it is my busy time of the year, I'll tell you. I'm up doing these interviews. I do a live show every night, singing and dancing and comedy out here at Knott's Scary Farm, which is the biggest Halloween venue in the country right now. And so I go to bed around 3, and then I get up at 7 to do interviews. Very busy.
Do you benefit from, it seems like Halloween season, it's starting earlier and earlier, because now as soon as school starts, we're seeing the costumes in stores. Does that get people more in the mood for what you do or earlier in the season?
Oh, yeah. I start working, doing Halloween, in the end of August. And it is a full-time, everyday job for me until October 31st. Actually, this year I'll even be working November 1st, so it's right now through the whole year. Pretty soon I'll just be working 365 days a year, I think.
And now, is that something you'd be interested in? Is obviously, everybody loves to work when you can get it. Is that something you'd love to try to stretch year-round?
Well, yeah, but, you know, I do love that it's a special holiday, you know, like
yeah.
that people don't see it all year, and then it makes it a little special when it pops up. So, you know, as much as it kind of is Halloween for me every day, I must say. But I like when it just comes around once a year. I don't think I could handle all this kind of work 365 days a year. I don't think I'd last.
Yeah, it would be, you know, because, oh, my gosh, you know, as a kid, it seemed like the season was so much shorter. And, I mean, I looked forward to it every single year. And I said, as soon as school started, I would circle the date on my calendar. I'd look forward to the Halloween specials on TV. And I guess if it was year-round, yeah, it would be much less special. The people would be kind of burned down on it, much like we're bombarded with Christmas year-round pretty much.
Yeah, Christmas. Oh, my gosh. They're starting already putting Christmas stuff, if you can believe that. I've seen some. It's like unbelievable. But for me, Halloween year-round would be great, actually, since I sell Halloween merchandise on my website, Elvira.com. But, you know, Halloween really, really is. It has always been my favorite holiday, even when I was a child. And I always think it's the best holiday because you don't have to have any boring dinners with your relatives. You don't have to go out and buy people gifts. You know, it's just all about me. You know what I mean? It's you go out, you have fun, you dress up, you have a blast, and it's kind of a, you know, very self-centered holiday, but that's one of the reasons why it's so fun, I think.
I never really thought about it that way, but you're right. Now I like it even more.
Yeah, there you go, see? It's such a great time of year.
So how did you become a part of, as a judge on Halloween Wars on Food Network? I mean, clearly your natural choice for this show, but did you have a relationship with someone at Food Network? Had you done stuff for them before?
No, I haven't. My only relationship is watching Food Network all the time because I love to cook and I love good food, so I watch it a lot. And so when I was called to do this, to judge it, I was like, yay, I'm going to go on something on Food Network. So I was thrilled to do this show. I had heard about it and seen it, and I was pretty amazed when I got to be on it. The kind of work these people do there's a cake artist, a sugar artist, and a pumpkin carver on these various teams. And by the time I get on the show, they're down to two teams. And the stuff they can do out of edible ingredients is really, really mind-boggling. I had no idea it was that good. So I kind of sat through the whole show with my mouth open going, yeah, oh, my God, you're kidding. So I had a blast on the show. The people there were so much fun, and what they make, it's called the Undead Dinner Party, and each of the teams has to come up with a whole scenario that looks like a spooky, creepy dinner party, and it was fascinating. I had a blast.
Yeah, I was wondering, there in the studio, if you get a better sense, because we see it on TV, obviously the different camera angles and everything, but just the size and the scale of what people come up with, it just seems like it's overwhelming and just massively impressive, the size and the detail they put into everything.
Oh, I was, you know, and seeing it up close and even smelling it and everything was really kind of mind-boggling for me. I had no idea people could do such a great job. It's a great show to watch, like just to get ideas, you know, about, you might, you know, a lot of people have their own little haunted house at home and things to do and what you can do with these various food ingredients. So it's pretty fun. I mean, it was just a blast. And being able to judge which team was good was awesome. They get $50,000. So, you know, that's nothing to sneeze at, right?
Well, you know, the trend on Food Network lately, it seems to be they've hired a lot of non-chefs. They've hired celebrities to host either like a cooking or an entertaining show. Have you thought about something like that now that you've got this as kind of a pilot? You could pitch that to them.
I know. I would actually love that. I love to cook. I it's one of my hobbies. So I was just watching the other day America's 10 Worst Chefs or something. And they have all these different celebrities on the list,
yeah.
who I know, which is kind of funny. But I would hate to go on something called America's 10 Worst, you know,
right.
cooks, because I would hope to God I don't qualify for that. But yeah, I would love to do something on there. And I have over the years gone on a few shows where I'll end up making some Halloween recipe, usually just something silly, you know, kind of a joke thing. But because I'll be dressed as Elvira and I'll be cooking something like stew from all your leftover trick-or-treat candy. Which that would be pretty scary, right?
I kind of like that idea.
Now, yeah, I actually said leave the wrappers on because that's where all the vitamins are.
Now, you mentioned earlier about your website. You've got a line of Halloween accessories and costumes?
Oh, yeah. Costumes, jewelry, apparel, candy bars this year, Elvira chocolate bars. And, you name it. Check out Elvira.com. Everything you need for your Elvira. For your Halloween party and your, everything, all year round. I dress as Elvira all year round, so I encourage other people to do that as well.
Did you ever get to meet Sven Gulli or son of Sven Gulli here in Chicago?
I sure did, both. I think I've met every living horror host that there's ever been, and I was a big fan and am a big fan of son of Sven Gulli, so many times we've crossed paths and... they're great. I have nothing but adoration for these other horror hosts who I kind of grew up with and who have been around, you know, as long or longer than me. So it was pretty awesome to meet them. And by the way, I'm going to be coming to the Chicago area. I should mention that towards the end of November, I'll be at Days of the Dead.
Oh, great.
Outside of Chicago.
Yeah.
So it'll be great because I haven't been there for a few years. So I'll be meeting fans and signing autographs, and I really look forward to it. I love Chicago.
So where do we keep up with you? Are you doing any Halloween tweeting or anything like that?
Oh yeah, I tweet, I Instagram. It's at the real Elvira. So yeah, look for me there. I'm involved right now. I'm performing out at Not Scary Farm, which is probably the largest and oldest Halloween venue in the country, and I perform there every night, live singing and dancing and comedy show. My show this year is called Elvira's Asylum. So, yeah, everybody, it was in the Southern California area. Can catch me there all through October. And doing a lot of other projects at the same time. So it's a busy, busy time for me.
And Halloween Wars, that is this Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. And look for special judge Elvira. Well, thank you so much for calling in today. Always wanted to talk to you.
You're welcome. Thank you. It's been fun.